call the property tax division to order. There's a little change in the agenda. Senator Pogemiller has commitments, and we'll need to move him up a little bit. So, Senator Pogemiller, Senate File 3159.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 3159 is a bill that deals with the definition of property and whether it will be defined for purposes of property taxation or for personal property taxation, personal property. And it deals with large industrial facilities, but in the case we're talking about, it's related to sugar beet processing facilities. This is an area that in the mid-80s, the legislature dealt with this and created the current body of law around it. And I think at that point, the legislature was thinking in terms of tightening up the statute to assure that there was a proper allocation of business property to local government. So I think the legislature kind of viewed the issue as kind of tightening up the language to avoid a loophole in the law in the 80s. Since then, there has been litigation around the issue. It's been to the Supreme Court, and the courts have strictly constructed the language, as would be assumed, and that has led to the introduction of this bill. The particular co-op we're talking about believes that they don't believe the assessor has properly assessed the property, but I think everybody else believes the assessor has properly assessed it. And there'll be some discussion around that, but I think ultimately the point gets down to, do we want to change the statute to make certain types of facilities change their classification? I think that's really where this is at. Again, I want to state that I believe there's still a dispute about whether the current law is being properly assessed. But from our point of view, I think you're going to find at some level that the court, the assessors, the Department of Revenue believe that it's being properly assessed based on the law. And so really it gets down to, do we want to change the law or not? I think that's really where we're at. And I'm going to turn to two. Let me just say there's a bill as introduced, and then there's an A1 amendment. And if you would just look at both of those during the discussion, because there may be multiple ways to approach this. And I think there may be a larger issue that the business community would like to create a pretty large change here. I would advocate for as modest a change as possible to maybe help in this type of facility, but obviously that's up to the committee. So two testifiers, Bob Hills is an attorney representing the Southern Minnesota Sugar Beet Co-op, and then Jim Gilbert, who is also representing the co-op. And I think, again, this has been in litigation. I think there's some continuing litigation, but I think we can separate that from the policy issue before us. So,
and, before we go to the testifier, Senator Pogemiller, as we look at the A1 amendment, I see you instead of sugar beet processing, you're using Section 273. Do you know what that is referring to directly?
Yes, that'll come up in the discussion here.
And is Mr.
I think it broadens out a little bit for other types of facilities.
And so, Senator Pogemiller, it would address that issue of this facility being similar to ethanol and grain processing and all of that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Which I'm, again, I only want to solve a small issue here. Now, if the committee is enthusiastic and wants to solve multiple issues, then maybe the broader language. But I think a smaller construct would probably be better for this session.
We're accustomed to you having good ideas. We'll see where it goes, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Hill, and I've been a property tax lawyer for about 18 years. I specialize in industrial facilities. 20 years ago, this committee was asked, or the legislature was asked, to take a look at a particular situation for RAR malting in Shakopee. I don't know if the committee knows, but they have some huge concrete silos that they use as part of their malting process. And the issue came up as to whether or not those silos should be treated as an improvement to the real property and treated as real property. The dispute boiled down to one fact, and that's that RAR Malting said, well, wait a minute, our silos are part of our barley and hop malting process, so therefore, oh, I'm sorry. So therefore, they should be exempt as production equipment, which the law of the state has always exempted any tank or bin that's involved in the production or distribution of a product as machinery. In fact, the Department of Revenue to this day treats tanks identical to our tanks as machinery. 86 out of 89 assessors treat tanks and bins. The best example I can give you is the four-story spam cooker in Austin, which protrudes and provides a shelter function, but it produces spam, and it's treated as exempt personal property under our statutes. Charlie Berg, I'm going to have Jim Gilbert talk about the legislative history, but the Department of Revenue said, well, we want to close a loophole for concrete silos. We think concrete silos are real estate, and therefore the exterior shells of them should be taxable as real estate. And that's what the legislature did. Unfortunately, instead of using the term concrete silo, what the legislature did is they called it a structure, which is was all-encompassing in the sense of it didn't just confine itself to concrete silos or, you know, storage bins or concrete structures, which are real estate and should be assessed and have been assessed as real estate. But it opened up the door to the possibility of going after production equipment through the back door. And by that I mean, and that's basically what's happened here, is that our tanks are called thick juice tanks, and they're made of steel, they're riveted together, they're sold as machinery, the only reason they're there is to help produce sugar, but they also have a shelter function. And so basically where we're at, and the reason we're before this committee, is just basically to say, right now we've got this inherent tension in the statute that needs correction one way or the other. As a practitioner, it's very difficult for me to advise my clients now because, again, if we're going to tax exterior shells of production equipment because they also provide a shelter function, then number one, the Department of Revenue has never done it, and to this day, underground storage tanks for service stations, for example, are treated by 87 out of 89 counties as exempt personal property. Well, they perform the same shelter function as our tanks. So what we're proposing to the legislature is that the mischief that the legislature wished to cure 20 years ago can be cured and should be cured. But if you use the term structure, it has no limiting principle. And what's happened now is that a private law firm has seized that exception to the exclusion and said, aha, we can now start taxing exterior shells of any bin or any tank or any silo in the state of Minnesota. And that is troubling because it's going to cause a great deal of consternation for the courts. It already has. And the other thing, and this is the part that I hope this committee will really consider, is there's no way to put a value on the exterior shell of a tank or bin. I'm going to take a risk right now and just show you what I mean. This is an egg. I bought it this morning for 55 cents. So I know how much it's worth. And if I'm an assessor, I could assess this egg at 55 cents. And I know I'm taking a risk. My co-counsel told me not to do this, but what the heck. This is the shell of the egg. How much is it worth? And the reason I bring it up is because if you don't cure this mischief, what we're going to have is the problem of valuing the shell with no basis to do it, because no appraiser, no person in the marketplace buys the shell of a bin. And I wanted to do a graphic example because we're not here asking for any huge change in the law. What we are saying is that if we're going to let private law firms bill counties $2 million to fight over what the value of the exterior shell of bins and tanks are, we got a problem. And all we're suggesting is that we need uniformity in the administration of the law. And as things stand, as I said, the Department of Revenue and 86 out of 89 assessors don't value the exterior shells of tanks and bins at all. Three counties have chosen to start doing it. And unfortunately, they've confined their assessment to the tanks and bins of sugar co-ops. But the camel's nose is under the tent. And that's why we went to Senator Pogemiller. Because if we're going to have a rule of taxation that allows you to start looking at this in a vacuum, I, as a practitioner, can't value it. Assessors can't either. And that what that's going to mean, ultimately, is enormous numbers of litigation where tanks and bins, which, again, we're only talking about production equipment here. We're talking about tanks and bins that their only reason for existence is to help produce products. So at the very time when our industrial base needs help, we're actually going to be expanding the taxability. And I do want to point out one last thing. I represent a co-op. That's 600 sugar beet farmers who own this facility. They bought these tanks and bins. They had no choice. So it's 600 families that are being assessed on the land where they grow the beets. And then they're being assessed at $131 a square foot on this beet processing. Of that, $17.5 million is the assessed value currently on our tanks and bins. $17.5 million. No other taxpayer in Renville County is even being assessed for the years we have in question. They're getting assessed zero on their tanks and bins. But if we don't change the statute, the time is going to come when assessors are going to just start throwing numbers out on these tanks and bins. And I as a practitioner, they're impossible to value. So all we're asking is that the committee consider the legislative history. I'm going to turn it over to Jim. Because if what the committee was meaning to do, or what the legislature was meaning to do in 1986, was to close a loophole on concrete silos, we have no problem with that. Assessors know how to value those and have been valuing them for 20 years. But they've never done the exterior shells of production tanks and bins. And we don't think that it's a wise policy, and the Supreme Court said as well, to continue to have this tension in the statute. Thank you for your time. And I'll turn it over to Jim.
Have you had breakfast, Mr. Chairman?
Well, Senator Pogemiller, I do have a question about the egg. About the egg and the tanks and bins. And it's obvious that the shell of the egg is critical to the egg being an egg. Is the shell of the bin critical to the bin and the production equipment used for sugar being a production equipment? That's your point.
That's my point, is that everything has structure. See, the statute now says that any structure that forms a shelter function. So, for example, those underground tanks for gas stations, which have always been exempt and are still exempt in 87, treated as exempt, they provide a shelter function, too, for the gasoline. So the problem is in not defining the term of art. If what the legislature meant to do in 86, which Senator Berg nailed it, and you'll hear from Jim in a minute on that, was to make sure that concrete silos, which are improvements to real estate, be assessed as real estate, that's what the term should have been. But by calling it a structure, there's no limiting principle. And that's the danger, because what it'll do is it's already allowing assessors to pick and choose which bins they want to tax and which ones they don't. Because, you know, just to give an example, railroad cars perform a shelter function, but they're not real estate. But under the definition that even the Supreme Court was required to strictly construe, they said, well, wait a minute, if it's got a roof, sidewalls, and a floor, and it serves a shelter function, it's taxable as real estate. And all we're saying is, if you're going to do that, number one, make sure that you have a uniform assessment, because right now the Department of Revenue treats them as machinery. When they do utility assessments, for example, there's a tank farm in northeast Minneapolis, and they have the big tanks like we do, and they're assessed as machinery. So that's why you see the subdivision B is that if you go back to MnStat 273.13 subdivision.
That's on the A1 he's talking about.
Yeah, on the A1. The law of the state of Minnesota already exempts tanks for any utility. So that's why I'm saying we got this inherent tension. So now in the private sector for my co-op, they're being assessed as real estate. Department of Revenue treats them as machinery, and 86 out of 89 assessors treat them as exempt machinery or exempt equipment. So something's got to change here, and that's why, as Senator Pogemiller said, we believe the easiest and clearest solution is to strike the term structure and insert the term concrete silos, or if you want to tax tanks and bins as real estate now, at least let's do it through the front door. Because right now, we're doing it through the back door, and I can tell you, when counties are spending $2 million on private law firms with no end in sight, there's a problem afoot here. But we didn't cause it. Anyway, I'm going to turn it over to Jim.
Mr. Gilbert.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Gilbert. I'm also one of the attorneys for the co-op. I'm also a former Minnesota Supreme Court justice. I served in that capacity for 7 years, and now I'm in the private practice. I would like to comment about the Supreme Court decision that came down in August 23rd of 2007. I argued that case, and I think it was the second time in the history of the state that a former justice had gone back in front of the Supreme Court and argued a case. And it was a historic moment because it was dealing with a lot of very, very important issues. We argued that the legislative history should be looked at because we felt that the statute was ambiguous. When a statute is clear and then ambiguous, the court never looks into the legislative history. We felt it was. And one of my arguments to the court was there was five law firms arguing on this issue that took five different positions on what the word structure meant. And just because of that alone, we should look into legislative history. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce submitted an amicus brief in support of our position. And I'd like to make that part of this record here, too, because within that is not only their brief, but the legislative history from the House, which debated this on April 1st, 1985, and the Senate on April 16th of 1985. And I don't know how I make that part of the record, but I would like to offer that, Mr. Chair. This was what was submitted to the Supreme Court. I meant to mention about the egg, too. I did warn my colleague not to use the egg, but if he did, to keep it in the bowl. He didn't follow my advice on either count, so we apologize for that. He just wanted to show what we're really dealing with here.
It was effective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I actually can't take credit for it. Kirkland and Ellis, back in 1932, Kirkland had a case where he peeled a potato in front of a jury, and it worked, so I figured I'd take a chance.
If I may quote the Supreme Court, they said the statute was clear and unambiguous. I respectfully disagreed with that conclusion, and if I was on the court, I might have written a dissent. But they handled it in a footnote, and they said the legislative history is at best unclear about exactly what the legislature intended when it enacted subdivision 1, paren C, paren small 3I. If I could just read two sections, short sections, of the legislative history. They were talking about malting facilities and kilns. And in the House version on page 2 of the legislative history, which I just made part of the record, it is stated that there is a kiln portion and a malting portion, and basically these are large structures, poured concrete or tilt-up concrete panels. And we're just not talking about the machinery inside these facilities that treats the barley as it's going through the process. And then if I could go to the Senate portion of the legislative history too, and that would be found on page 4 and page 5 of the legislative history. Mr. Wanmacher testified there, and he was representing the Revenue Department at that point in time on this same issue. And here's what he stated. We were sitting a little while ago trying to think of what types of buildings or structures that might be put back on the tax rolls. And this was specifically in response to two tax court decisions that had been decided, one in Winona and one in Shakopee. And it says, the only one that I can think of right offhand are these malting facilities and perhaps some test cell facilities that the airlines operate at the Metropolitan Airport facility in Minneapolis. And then on the next page, on page 5, Senator Berg stated this, the problem that I have right now is, will your department then, if you're successful in getting an audible back on the tax roll, then how far are you going to go? Are you going to come out after the rest of us? The answer from Mr. Wanmacher from the Revenue Department was, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berg, if this bill happens to pass, I think we're going to instruct the assessor as to what the intent of the bill was, and that was to put the malting facilities back on the tax roll, period. End of quote. And for 20 years, from 1985 till about 2003 or 2004, the legislative history was followed by the Revenue Department, and then Renville County came up with this novel idea, say, well, wait a minute, you know, these big agricultural production facilities have roofs, have sides, have floors, and they're real estate. They're made out of carbon steel. They can be assembled and disassembled. They can be sold and resold, not like a normal piece of real estate. They were clearly not equivalent to what the malt facilities were in 1985. They did not have tilt-up concrete walls. They didn't look like a building. And, in fact, the Supreme Court made one of its findings that this is, in fact, production equipment. That's right in the Supreme Court opinion. But they said because it has these other attributes of roofs and sides and walls and floors, it should be taxed as real estate. And as Mr. Hill said, there's no bounds on that whatsoever. Every propane tank, every rolling stock car, every production piece of equipment that's out in a yard that is not covered by a roof, if you will, would be taxable.
And I just want to add, one of the reasons that this committee should act and cure this mischief is if we are unsuccessful, because they're taxing our tanks at millions, tens of millions of dollars. Well, what we'll do is we'll just instruct our client to go and get one of those little artificial tent things and blow it up, make it big enough so that it encapsulates all our tanks, because you can buy those or build them for about $15 a square foot. And so that's the mischief here, is that if we don't have a limiting principle, it's going to cause absolutely illogical activity in the marketplace, because my co-op isn't going to continue to pay $131 a square foot on these tanks when it could put up what amounts to a roof like the Metrodome roof for $15.
If I could add one comment beyond that to the assessors.
Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final two points are the assessors are not taxing filling station holding tanks that are underground. They have the same qualities as facilities as our clients, which are above ground, and they gave us absolutely no reason why they would tax our tanks, but not the service station tanks that are buried tanks. Finally, the Supreme Court said that the co-op and the chamber statutory interpretation is in essence a debate over the wisdom of the subdivision. This debate should be waged in the legislature, not in the judicial branch. And I would respectfully request that this legislature clarify and go back to their legislative history that stood true for 20 years and clarify this and stop this, I'm called novel, almost unprecedented approach to tax production equipment as if it was real estate.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Pogemiller, there's a couple other folks that want to testify. Mr. Fox, or Commissioner Fox from Renville, and Mr. Vanosik. Could we hear from those folks?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Vanosik, and I'm here representing the Renville County Board of Commissioners. The bill before you today would attempt to reverse a portion of the decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which recently held that the exterior shells of bins, tanks, and silos used at the Southern Minnesota Sugar Beet Cooperative that's located in Renville County were, in fact, taxable real property. The sugar beet plant and Renville County are currently engaged in continuing litigation regarding the assessed value of the real property at the sugar beet plant for the taxable years 2004 through 2008. It's my understanding that they're scheduled to proceed to trial on the pay 07 and 08 years next month. I'm not here to argue that court case, and I don't think you want that court case to be argued in front of you. We feel that these court proceedings should be allowed to run their course without interference from the legislature. The bins and tanks and silos that this bill seeks to exempt from property taxes would reduce the existing taxable market value for these processing plants by about one-third. Renville County estimates that if this bill is enacted, it would shift approximately $12 million of market value off of the plant and onto other property taxpayers in the county. That would be a big impact for a county the size of Renville. We would argue that there is no functional difference between the bins, the tanks, and the silos at sugar beet processing plants and the grain bins and silos at farms and elevators throughout the state, not to mention other storage facilities such as oil storage tanks at refineries. Passage of the bill would significantly increase the likelihood that many other taxpayers, both individual and corporate, would be contesting their real estate tax with the argument that there is no functional difference between their storage silo or bin and a sugar storage silo or bin, or between their storage tank or a thick sugar juice storage tank, and that they should also be exempt from taxation. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Vinosik. And Commissioner Fox, welcome to the Property Tax Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'll make my remarks very short. As a farmer, I have tanks on my farm, and I just flew in from D.C., so I didn't have a lot of time to do research. But I believe my tanks on my farm are taxed. So I can't believe how Mr. Hill and Mr. Gilbert can say that they are the only ones in Renville County that their tanks are being taxed. The committee, I ask one thing. You look at this matter and look at it very serious, because I've served on a township board and now as a county commissioner. And what you do here is going to have ramifications, serious ramifications. And I believe if you do what they ask, we are going to have other people here, ethanol plants, the Cargills, the Cenexes, everyone's going to have a piece of equipment that's some kind of special equipment. The ramifications that's going to happen are very serious, and I hope you take very serious matter on this. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And Mr. Vinosik, we get the shift issue, and this committee in the past has a history of not having that shift occur because homeowners are struggling with their property taxes as it is. But the issue about, and it's interesting, Commissioner, you talked about every industry is going to come and ask for this same exemption, but they made the same argument that if we don't fix this, the assessors are going to then tax all of these. So we'll have to sort through that and see what's going to be the case. And I think questions, members? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe as an extension of that, if we only do it for sugar beet processing, we're going to see a line of folks in the coming years coming to the legislature to define an exemption for their industry. And I don't know enough about how many different processing facilities use these types of shells, but that it seems to me that if we're going to address it, we might want to think about addressing it in a broader fashion.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Vinosik. Senator Pogemiller and Mr. Hagan from the department would like to come up and give us a little perspective from the department's point of view. Mr. Hagan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director at the Property Tax Division. I'd like to weigh in a little bit on some of what the testimony in the department's perspective of what constitutes real and personal property. We basically feel our perspective is and has been since 1973, quite honestly, when we issued a bulletin that we refer to always as the Lewis Plutzer Bulletin in August of 1973, where we talked about basically what is and is not personal property, what's real estate. And we've always drawn the line that real estate, tanks are taxable as real estate if they serve a shelter, containment, or a storage function. We've always felt that if the tanks in question were part of a production process or part of, in the case of Mr. Hill referenced, in the case of the underground storage tanks, in this particular bulletin we actually spoke specifically to underground storage tanks. And at that time we said that underground storage tanks were exempt because they were an extension of the gas pumps and consequently not part of the real property. And we differentiate between the underground storage tanks with the above-ground storage tanks that would contain basically the same oil. If the storage tank, above-ground storage tanks, we've always held are taxable because they are used for the storage or shelter function. Again, the underground storage tanks, we've always held since the 1973 bulletin at least, that they're part of the fueling process and exempt. An analogous example would be in the case of grain bins that are clearly taxable under the existing law, although at the moment grain bin silos, things like that are taxable. And if you contrast that to a hopper bottom bin, which might be adjacent to a hog confinement barn, for instance, that they have an auger where they're augering grain out into the hog confinement on a daily basis and they're filling the grain bin numerous times during the day, we would hold that that's part of the feeding function and not a storage function. That's analogous to using it for just part of the feeding in that case.
And, Mr. Hagen, did I hear you say that an underground fuel tank is treated differently than an above-ground fuel tank?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Is that it, Mr. Hagen?
Pardon me?
Is that the if for you?
Yeah, that's point?
Mr. Hagen, you've heard this. Are we going to have a problem with consistency in these bins as we move around the state?
My concern is that if we change the law, it's been remarkably trouble-free, quite honestly, since the 73 bulletin. There's been very little litigation in the area of personal property and real estate. There was a flurry of it back in the early 70s where we litigated billboards at Scoglund Communications and exempted billboards. I think KDAL exempted towers, but there's been remarkably little litigation in the area of personal property and real estate. The sugar beet plant was a recent one, and I believe we had one back in the 80s involving Thunder Canyon, which is a riot at Valley Fair. But other than that, there's been really, based on our bulletins and interpretation of law, there's been remarkably little confusion, I would say, from the part of assessors, and I am concerned that incrementally diminishing or excluding a part could start a whole new flurry of activity.
And Mr. Hagen, could you tell me what the status of the court is now? I know there's been a court case that was won and lost, and is there more litigation going on now?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's some litigation taking place that was just heard in the last week or so regarding crystal sugar in Polk County, in your area. And I believe that litigation just concluded. I think that was about valuation, and I don't believe they got into it. I could stand corrected, but I'm not sure that got into whether bins were taxable or not.
Mr. Chair, may I? Mr. Chair, yep. And members of the committee? That's why we think it's important for the legislature to start looking at this now as a policy matter. Because, as Mr. Hagen has said, the department issued a bullet in 73 saying if it's part of a production process or distribution process, it's exempt as personal property. So, for example, the Minneapolis city assessor, the Star Tribune has a four-story ink tank that sits outside of its factory in Maple Grove, and it stores ink, but it produces newspaper. So it's always been exempt.
Okay.
The mischief began when a private law firm said, aha, there's an unlimited exception to the exclusion, and I'm going to take advantage of it, and I'm going to make it applicable at least to my clients.
So, which case is that?
That was our case. Yeah, we were the first one. We were the test case. And that's why this has been confined to sugar beet co-ops. So in terms of the litigation, Mr. Chair, in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and as far as I know, 2008, no assessors other than these three counties are looking at these production tanks. And again, I'm not talking about storage, because storage of finished products such as oil, that's always been treated as assessed. And we actually have some concrete silos. We're not contesting those. But we have these huge tanks that are their only reason for being is that they're part of our production process for sugar, just like the underground tanks are part of the production or distribution of gasoline. So there's no distinction in terms of functionality. But here's where the litigation stands. It's going to shift from taxability because the Supreme Court has said the exterior shells of these, as the statute's currently written, they're taxable. But now what the question is, have you taxed them? And the answer is no, except for, so we're being singled out. So the litigation's now going to shift from, trying to pick a number out of thin air, because again, there's no way to put a value on the exterior shell of a steel tank. It's just, that's not how they're sold. But setting that aside, now it's going to be, well, have you uniformly administered the law? And the answer is no, we haven't. Because the Department of Revenue since 1973 has given a long laundry list. And by the way, we're on that laundry list. Our tanks have been exempt, and we're exempt all the way up until April of 2006, when this private lawyer said, go back and retroactively assess them now. But when you, that bulletin he's talking about?
Mr. Hill, yeah. You keep referring to this private attorney.
Yeah.
Wasn't this the county of Renville?
No, and that's the problem. And Commissioner Fox can, you know, he's told our lobbyists that this has been taken out of the hands of the commissioners altogether and the lawyers are handling it. And that I find very troubling. I'm not kidding you when I say $2 million in the hands of a private law firm to talk about how many angels dance on the head of a pin is not the way to make public policy.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little confused about where the $2 million comes from. Does it come from the county? It seems to me the county board would have control over that. I think we need to learn more about that. Maybe the folks from Renville County could provide us some details with how that process occurred and when they made the decision, how the decision was made to move forward with evaluation and taxation.
Fair enough, Senator Larson. Yeah, what I'm quoting
Mr. Hill,
is...
Just slow down a little bit here.
Sure.
Senator Pogemiller, we're going to lay this over and look at it, so you know we'll do some research. But Commissioner Fox, could you come up and clarify for us?
Chair
Commissioner
and committee,
Fox.
When Renville County hired outside legal counsel was when... the beet plant took us to tax court.
Right.
And we hired a law firm to represent us at that tax court in those hearings. That is when we hired outside legal counsel.
And Commissioner Fox, what was the beet plant taking you to court for?
For their valuations.
On the valuation. And as an outcome of that, then the amount that was being taxed was included this then. I don't want to expand it. But after that, then it included this. You went to the Supreme Court in Renville County. The Supreme Court ruled in your favor. And so now we're going to have to struggle between whether we're more concerned about counties expanding what they've been taxing to include these for printers or whoever, or are we going to give exemptions where we probably shouldn't. So we're going to try to figure this out.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask Mr. Hill, was the company just talking about the amount that was being, or was it the definitional issue?
Oh, no.
Which facilities were being taxed?
Yeah, Senator Pogemiller,
Mr.
Chair. Yeah, the original assessed values exempted all of our tanks and bins and silos. It was a 20, we were contesting the fact that the buildings, the sheds, the real estate was assessed at $20 million at that time, and which is about $60 a square foot, and pretty much all the other industrial in the state is assessed at $10 to $15. So in retribution, they said, we'll double the assessment. So just to be clear.
Mr. Hill, it might have been an unintended consequence for you, but it's something that happened.
Well, I should just stick to the record. With the original assessments we were contesting, these tanks and bins were already exempted.
I get that, Mr. Hill. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've got enough information now to think some more about this.
Yeah, and I think Senator Pogemiller, you know, as I said, we're going to lay this over and work on this and see where we're going to go with this. As I said, you know, I'm obviously concerned about the shifts, but on the other hand, you know, we don't really want to have a can of worms exploding on us and every county in the state going to court. And we don't also want, in your case, things being, you know, now taxed that aren't or untaxed that should be. So with that, we'll lay Senator Pogemiller, what do you want us to do? What should we do with the A1 amendment?
You know, Mr. Chairman, why don't we just think about all those? I would like to try to get something done this year, and if we're not able to solve all problems, maybe a modest change, but if that creates another problem, then... So I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I think we ought to keep both of those in play and try to decide.
Yep.
I think paragraph 2 on the A1 clearly makes it a broader issue.
Yeah.
Just the concrete silo issue by itself, maybe that's narrow enough. It doesn't create this can of worms, but I think we need to think about all that.
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, you know this, but I just want people in the audience to be aware. Part of the reason we're sensitive to tax shifting in different classes of property is when we tax shift onto homes, those homeowners then, more homeowners become eligible for the state's property tax refund program, so the state pays out more checks to homeowners, so we have to carry that as a cost. So, I mean, we sometimes when we're well-intentioned of trying to provide some relief, it, you know, you think of property taxes shifting as not being a cost, but oftentimes there is a state cost, and it can be significant. So, I mean, facing a $1 billion deficit, doing things that are going to create additional tax credits that the state has to pay out, well-intentioned as we might be, are sometimes in these economic times very difficult. I just want people to be sensitive to that, that it does increase the deficit if to the degree we do this.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. And,
thank you, Senator Pogemiller.
I'll be visiting with you.
Yep.
Thanks.
Will a Senate file 3159 with the A1 amendment alongside over for possible inclusion?
Yep. A structure or a concrete.
No, I'm going to go up there.
Not going to wheel it away either.
Members, the next bill we'll be hearing is Senate File 3234, Senator Skoy. And Mayor Coleman will be joining Senator Skoy to begin with. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you know, members, we have been looking, certainly the last couple years and longer, for solutions to rising property taxes. One of the mechanisms that we have looked at as a very good way to afford property tax relief for Minnesotans is to provide increased aids to the cities that provide services. And one of the issues that has always been around as we talk about local government aid to cities is the way that those dollars are distributed. So this last interim and early winter, the communities, the cities have been working on a different method of redistribution, and we are here to talk about that today. I believe that we're also going to discuss some of the budget needs and some of the other needs of the cities. This bill does have a significant increase in LGA, about the size that the Senate bill had last year, not the conference committee report, but significant LGA for Minnesota cities. I'm pleased to be here with Mayor Coleman from St. Paul, and I think we'll turn it over to Mayor Coleman.
Thank you. Mayor Coleman, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Chris Coleman, Mayor of the City of St. Paul. I want the record to reflect if Senator Skoy suddenly takes ill over the next couple of days, he is sitting in a pile of raw egg yolk. the egg analogy actually could be appropriate for the situation that cities across Minnesota are finding themselves in. I don't know whether it would be a raw egg or a hard-boiled one. Raw would reflect the fragile state we're in. The hard-boiled egg would reflect the fact that we've been in hot water for a long time. The fact of the matter is cities are facing a lot of challenges, as is the state of Minnesota and, quite frankly, the country. We have in the state the $935 million deficit in the budget. Cities across the state of Minnesota, large and small, are facing huge challenges with mortgage foreclosures. Many of our children are entering kindergarten without the basic needs that they need to be successful. The cost of fueling our police cars and heating our buildings is skyrocketing. Now more than ever, we need to do a better job of recognizing the challenges before us. And we need to come together across partisan lines and geographical divides to find solutions for a better Minnesota. The bill before you, Senate File 3234, is dubbed the Unity Bill, and it really is a bill that, first of all, is a product of cities coming together of all sizes and shapes. It is a bill that will, I believe, get Minnesota moving again. For the first time in recent memory, Minnesota cities are speaking with one voice on the urgency and desperate need for real property tax relief for our cities and our citizens. We've struggled and worked together to find a formula that can bring all of us together. Communities like Duluth, Park Rapids, Hastings, Chaska, Rochester, and St. Paul, to name a few, will see significant gains under the proposal before you. Minnesota cities have played by the rules and have been good stewards of public resources despite devastating LGA cuts since 2003. For example, the City of St. Paul has maintained our AAA credit rating, as well as receiving a municipal financial management rating of strong from S&P, an honor conferred on fewer than 10% of the municipalities rated by Standards and Poor. You have before you two handouts, and I think the handouts demonstrate the significant need for an increase in local government aid to cities across the state of Minnesota. The first handout illustrates, I believe it would be the Senators, if I could, we don't have a numbering system, but it's headlined "State Government is Growing on the Backs of Local Governments." Well, I like that title. This one illustrates that the local government has contributed more than its fair share to make up for a lackluster economic growth. For example, from 2003 to 2008, state government has retained 7.1% of its state revenue, while city governments across the state have lost nearly 12% of their revenue. It should also be pointed out, and Senator Scoy was mentioning, you may be familiar with another chart that we have used in the past, which is show that despite significant increases in property taxes across cities throughout the state of Minnesota, the total amount of revenue that is available to cities to provide basic needs like police and fire services has actually decreased. The second chart that shows the bar graph with the title "Even in a Deficit, Minnesota Needs at Least $90 Million Increase in Local Government Aid" just shows what the trend lines would have been had we had normal and predictable inflationary increases in local government aid since 2003. If you use the government inflation index, you have about $260 million shortfall from what we would have received. If you use kind of the standard consumer index, it's about $190 million less in total aid. So the $90 million that's contained in the bill before you is only a portion of what we would have had we had predictable and steady increases. It is in order for the entire state to grow and prosper, we need to set the table with good transit, clean developable land, and infrastructure to promote economic development. Minnesota used to depend on being one of the most highly ranked states with respect to educational attainment, public health, entrepreneurship, environmental quality, and on and on. Those rankings require a higher level of local investment than our property taxpayers can or should be asked to afford. Each year that we fail to fully fund local government aid, we allow Minnesota to fall further and further behind. None of us wants to be a part of the race to the bottom. Local government aid grew out of the fundamental truth that we in Minnesota share a common destiny. From War Road to Winona, from St. James to St. Paul, we are one state, bound together by a common future. I believe that the bill before you gets us back on a road to prosperity, gets us back on a road where Minnesota has the reputation that it has earned over the years and really maintains the quality of local government services across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Are there questions for Mayor Coleman? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next on our agenda for testimony is Tom Goodwin, council member from Apple Valley and president of Metro Cities. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, maybe we'll bring, I think there's two more.
Couple more. Good idea, Senator Scoy. Why doesn't Mark Stephenson, the mayor of Maple Grove, and the president of the North Metro Mayors Association also join Mr. Goodwin at the table? And actually, let's bring Steve Cook from the Mayor Hutchinson up as well. Very good. Mr. Goodwin, good to see you again.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes, it's nice to be here.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. I think Mayor Coleman made most of the points, but I'd like to just kind of sum a few of those up. First of all city groups agree on this. Now, I don't know how often you see that around here, but I think it's almost historic. When you consider the fact that all city groups agree on this, plus you've had a broken egg in your testimony room in the same day, I'm sure that's a day that'll never be repeated. But and another point I'd like to make that all LGA is something we've all talked about for years, but it's very well known in our organization that it just doesn't work very well for some cities that really have need. They have substantial need, and it's just not working well for them. Another thing I'd like to point out, which I think is very important, this is a short long-term solution. As you all know, there's a study group going on that's meeting right now that hopefully is going to bring you folks some more substantial solutions to the whole LGA problem in the year 2009. So this is short-term, and please keep that in mind as you go through this process. Now, I'm the president this year of the Metro Cities, and I'd like to tell you how it's going to impact our group. For purposes here, I'm going to kind of break it up among three. The Metro Cities, first of all, I start with the two core cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. This bill kind of holds them harmless. It gives St. Paul a little bit more money. So Minneapolis isn't moving ahead under this bill, and St. Paul isn't losing money. They're getting a little bit more money. And then I'd like to discuss for a second the city that I represent. The city of Apple Valley gets no LGA. We haven't had LGA since the year 2000. We're not looking for LGA. We understand very well the problem you folks are having up here. And there's a whole bunch of cities in our group that haven't had LGA since the year 2000. And I just want to emphasize, we're not looking for money for LGA right now. Now, I always feel I have to give a disclaimer when I say this. I don't need people saying that, hey, the guy from Apple Valley was here and says they don't care if they ever have LGA. What I'm saying to you is if LGA is ever funded again at the level it was in the year 2000, and we can participate in the program, we'd be more than happy. But right now, we do understand your situation. But the group I really like to talk to you about is what we call our first tier or first ring suburbs. I sometimes think there's some misunderstanding out there about folks, especially from outstate. They just kind of throw all suburbs together. They kind of lump us together. Believe me, Edina is not Columbia Heights, and Ridgefield is not Eden Prairie. They're all different. The first ring suburbs have tremendous need. They would have need, I think, equal to what we see outstate. So please keep that in mind as you go through this, through your deliberations, that the folks that don't have it right now, the Apple Valleys, Eden Prairies, and the rest of us, we're not looking for more money now. The Bloomingtons, you know that, Senator. We're not looking for more money. But we have some real needs in our first-ring suburbs, and I think those needs are equal to or greater than the outstate cities. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Goodwin, and I appreciate your comments. I think you very well lay out the fact that we recognize in communities that don't receive LGA, and I'm from Bloomington, don't my community does not as well, although I represent Ridgefield, Minneapolis, and from communities that don't receive it also recognize the impacts of the communities that surround us as well and how those communities can impact us as well, and helping the communities that need it is very necessary. And our next testifier, Mark Stephenson, the mayor of Maple Grove, and I believe you're in the same spot.
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. I do think it's a fair statement to say that I think there are a group of suburbs that aren't looking for it because we understand the situation, and I think that's appropriate. But I think that, as was explained here earlier, I am also the president of the North Metro Mayors Association, and that includes a number of these inner-ring, first-tier suburbs that truly need the help that they currently aren't receiving. And that's what this bill really does help solve. It helps solve some of the other issues that exist. And one of the things I do want to bring up is, you know, first of all, certainly all the city groups are on board, which I think is tremendously important for you as a legislature to consider. We've looked at this as our representing our different groups and realized this is how we can come together and solve some problems that exist. And one of the problems that really hasn't just been discussed that I think is really a significant problem under the current formula that this at least stabilizes for 3 years is the volatility factor. There are a number of our inner-ring suburbs and a number of the greater Minnesota cities that have seen over the last year or two the volatility of the system, a small little adjustment in one of the factors, and all of a sudden you're losing $500,000, you're losing $800,000 in LGA in a small budget, and you can't afford that. And so that is one of the important factors of this bill as well, as it fixes or solves for a temporary period of time the volatility factor. I think that's tremendously important. As we consider as a city our budgets and going forward, we need to know what they are because, like happened last year, the LGA numbers came out after the cities had established their base budget numbers. And all of a sudden, you have a hole in your budget of $500,000 or $800,000. You don't know what to do. And that has happened over the last few years, and that's what this bill fixes as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Next is the Mayor of Hutchinson, Steve Cook. Welcome, Mayor Cook.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here also to represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. LGA is critical to greater Minnesota. And our cities provide, besides the basic services, we're also responsible for providing services like municipal sewers, airports, libraries. So funding, you know, for those things are important. We also have challenges of less tax base. And then with the distance between our cities, there's less abilities to partner and to save and reduce costs that way. So we need LGA to help us provide our services at a reasonable cost, at a reasonable tax rate to our property taxpayers. And since the cuts in 2003, you know, we've had to tighten our belts just like metro cities have had to. And a lot of our cities have had to raise taxes at the same time as reduce services. So our residents, our property taxpayers, are paying more and getting less for that. So that's really why we support, you know, more funding for the LGA program. At the same time, we recognize that there's metro cities that really have suffered through the cuts as well, and that they need more money too. So we support this bill because it helps provide more money for the metro cities that need it, as well as more funding for greater Minnesota as well. And you know, this helps to provide or correct some of those inequalities, but then also provide some of the stability that's been talked about. And we see this as just strengthening, you know, that partnership with the state is what the LGA program was all about before. It doesn't get us back to where we should be to fully fund the program, but it gets us a lot closer. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Steve Peterson, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Peterson's coming up, we do have more testifiers. Are you guys going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of the formula?
That's correct.
Let's do, let me do a little bit before they get to that. First of all, with regard to the volatility fix, I think Senator Bach and the tax bill that's passed yesterday, we do have a two-year averaging included in there. This is a little different volatility measurement, so we'll take a little run at that. But I did want to say, you know, we have worked on this LGA formula for a while to try to address communities that have need that aren't currently covered under the LGA formula. And, you know, last year we had a proposal to address rental housing as a factor to address some of their needs. And to be honest, I never really liked that because I didn't think it was a good policy for the state to do, to say that having rental housing was expensive for communities. And so, you know, we struggled with that. This formula change is dealing with jobs and some of the overburden that you have in a community when people are traveling in and out of your community for work. And so we're working on this, and I think the communities, the cities, have come a long ways. With regard to the small cities, as I look at this, when you're in a rural small community, and you really don't have a huge job base, and it's hard to attract jobs in, and your population is kind of declining, I think they have a special situation, and I probably should have offered the A1 amendment before. The testifiers came up, so they would have had a chance to respond to it, but I didn't get to it till right now. And so, members, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment, and I've run this by a number or some of the folks that were working on the compromise. I don't think it's a deal breaker, but before these folks talk about the meat of the bill and the formula, I'd like to get this in so they're talking about this also. And so this is a formula for that these small cities uses their highest population. It is a small $800,000 shift around in the formula. I think it's something good for the committee to consider. And so I'll do this as an author's amendment. This is the first stop this bill has had. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
Senator Scoia offers the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Senator Scoia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I think we'll turn it over to the folks that really were working on the formula for them to walk us through what exactly is going on.
Mr. Peterson.
Chairman, members, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm with Flaherty and Hood, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. But today I'm also here on behalf of the Metro Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Small City Association, and the North Metro Mayors Association, the City of St. Paul, and the City of Minneapolis, because we are all supporting the formula changes that we worked very hard to get to. And I will go over those changes of what this bill is and how we got there. The largest change in the bill is the elimination of the regional center aid and its replacement with an aid for overburden based on the amount of jobs per capita. Currently in the formula, any city in greater Minnesota outside the seven-county area that is over that was over 10,000 in the year 2000 received regional center aid. This has caused problems as we look going into it as it's a very arbitrary line, a line of overburden just in greater Minnesota, a line of overburden just for cities over 10,000. The city of Alexandria in the year 2000 was at 9,800 and some change and is now above 10,000, yet does not receive the regional center aid. The city of Thief River Falls is not even close to 10,000, but is a regional center. So we replace that for all cities in Minnesota over 5,000 in population with a overburden aid based on the amount of jobs that you have in relation to your population. If you think about this, it makes sense. If you have a lot of jobs compared to your population, that means you're going to have more people coming into your city during the day. You're going to need more services during the day and wider roads to carry the traffic in there. So it is a snapshot of overburden. And if you think about the city of Thief River Falls, they have 40% of the people who work in Thief River Falls do not live in Thief River Falls. That was a city that would not have received the regional center aid prior to this bill. For small cities, we have a doubling, for small cities being cities under 5,000, we have a doubling of its per capita aid from $6 to $12 per person. This has now been changed to be for its highest population, a highest census population that it has had. For both of the regionals, for the jobs-based aid and the small city aid, we have made a change to the formula that has both of these aid bases incorporate its tax base. Prior to this bill and the current formula, you receive small city aid regardless of how much tax base you had in your city. The same with regional center aid. With both of these now, we take the jobs-based aid and we add it to the difference between the need and effort portion of the current formula. What that does is the jobs-based aid, if you just looked at it without the tax-based effort, one of the cities that has the most jobs per person is Bloomington, Eden Prairie, and Edina. But these cities have strong job bases or strong tax bases in part because they have a good jobs base. On the other hand, a city like Fridley has a considerable amount of jobs per capita but does not have a corresponding tax base increase. And with the small cities, this would then take away from a city like in North Oaks, who is currently receiving small city aid, and a city right next to it, Arden Hills, which is above 5,000, does not. Both are very strong tax-based communities. This would make it more congruent across the board. Additionally, in the need portion of this formula, which is the regression analysis that a lot of people like to talk about and complain about, that has the pre-40 housing, the auto accidents, and the population decline for cities over 2,500, we put in a minimum need of $290 per person. Currently, the need formula, based on that regression, says that some cities can actually run off of a revenue stream of $186 per person. This is not true in reality. Most cities spend more than $290 per person. So we put in this minimum need, saying this was a regression analysis. This is a social science, not a hard science. And since most cities are at this level, we put this minimum need in there. It removes the taconite aid offset, which I'm sure will be done before this bill goes through. Additionally, it has a – this bill is based off of an increase of $90 million. $90 million is where we think we should be at, where we should be going for. However, it does have the ability to be scaled down if needed. Basically, it's based off – the calculation is based off of an increase of $90 million, but if you were to have less, you just scale back the proportion of your increase by the percentage that you lower than $90 million increase. A big portion of this bill, too, that has been alluded to is the stability that it puts into play. And what it does is it, after the 2009 distribution is put out, we freeze everyone's share of LGA for the next 2 years. So if you're a city receiving 1% of the total, you would receive 1% for the next 2 years. If there was a $20 million increase in the out year, you would receive 1% of that $20 million increase. The reason that we are doing this is twofold. One, the jobs component of it right now is a major component of this formula, and we don't want to becoming a long-term idea of having it based so strongly on jobs. Jobs is a good snapshot of overburden, but we don't want to be in a place where if you have a town that loses a factory or loses a headquarters, and all of a sudden they're losing a lot of jobs, and now we're going to take some LGA away from them. While it's a good snapshot of overburden, we don't want it to be the overriding factor for a long-term solution. It might be in the mix as a portion of the new formula, but not the primary one. Additionally, when we freeze the share, we take out that volatility so that we can actually sit down and work on a long-term formula solution. One of the problems we have as we look to create a long-term formula solution is we have this city going up $500,000. Now they expect they should be there. A city going down $500,000. Well, now we got to get their money back. And you multiply that by the 800 and some cities in the state, it makes it very difficult to form a solution when you have all these cities moving around thinking that they need more or they now deserve as much as they get that year. And I think that's a very important factor of this, because during that time of the 2 years, we will be sitting down and working on a study so that we can come up with a long-term solution for the LGA formula. Two additional points. This does look to the out years of putting the LGA appropriation back to an inflationary increase every year again. It uses the 2008 certified data to calculate the 2009. One of the major problems that we have right now is every year we recalculate the formula, we have these estimates put out there, but we don't get the final data for the formula, the population, until midsummer. So then we have this adjustment to our projections. And most of the time it's not a big deal, but sometimes it can be a big deal. And cities are in the middle of doing their budgeting, and all of a sudden they have to figure out where to cut another $100,000 or $1 million, depending on what size city they are. And with that, I'd just like to add that this program does add 8 cities to the LGA. Eight new cities will be receiving LGA. Another 13 cities will have their LGA doubled that were receiving very low funding from prior and the current formula. And with that, I think I've covered it all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Jamboy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm with Metro Cities. I don't have anything really to add to Mr. Peterson's testimony, except that we endorse this proposal. We really strongly endorse the freeze of the program while we take the time to create a stronger program, a better program for the future. We think that the program creates some significant improvements in the short term. But we all know that we have to get together as a community of cities with House and Senate staff and with the Department of Revenue to create a long-term solution to LGA. And this proposal will buy us the time, we think, to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop.
Mr. Barnhart. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Bill Barnhart. I'm here on behalf of North Metro Mayors. Again, I think Mr. Peterson has given a very good explanation. And would really develop this particular, albeit different than what the League had proposed last year, which was an improvement, by the way, but it basically took two volatile numbers and averaged them. This basically is saying we're going to take the volatility out of the system for 3 years while we have all agreed to be working on a new formula, which, number one, should be more understandable to more people. I think one of the problems with the current system is you have to have a system that finance directors, mayors and councils, and legislators, you know, at least understand, and especially so that you can answer this question when somebody says, well, why did that city get this? And in my mind, I'm the same. Well, although Gary and Steve and myself can try to run you through the multiple regression analysis, you just see the eyes glazing over, and they do not understand. We've got to be able to get that type of question through. This particular arrangement would do the would provide a volatility fix and take us into a stability period so that we could all work on this particular type of improvements.
Mr. Carlson, please state your name for the record.
Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd just like to thank Senator Scoy for listening to this idea. We really appreciate him taking the time and considering the city community's proposal.
Other questions? Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know which one of our panelists want to take a run at this, but let me just say I really appreciate all the work that the cities have put into this. You know, and they, I realize they all come to the table with, you know, very diverse communities, and most of them with a lot of need, and I appreciate all the work that was put into this. But let me, whoever wants can take a shot at this. I still think there is a small problem that we need to, that I don't think we address yet. And let me use Grand Marais as the example. I use Grand Marais because I think everybody in the room knows where Grand Marais is. Grand Marais is a little town of about 1,100 people. And in the entire county, there are only 5,000 people. About 65% of the tax capacity of the entire county is seasonal recreation. And anybody that's been up the North Shore knows that tens of thousands of people shop in Grand Marais and stop there to buy gas or do whatever. And you got a little town, 1,100 people, with, frankly, a relatively small tax capacity in the city. But there is a huge overburden in that little town. And I see we put $90 million into the formula, and they get zero. So I think there's maybe an additional overburden issue outside of the jobs issue. Probably it's in a very small number of communities, but I think there's a pretty strong argument there. You know, the tax capacity is right outside the town. And I'd like, if you could, spend a little time thinking about that, how we could. I think it's a small number of towns. And then the second thing I would say is the town that I call home is not much different in Cook, where you've got Lake Vermilion. And I notice on the other end of the lake over at Tower, Tower's a little town of 300-400 people, and I hear from them quite often that, you know, they service a big part of Lake Vermilion with, frankly, billions of dollars of tax capacity outside of their city. But that little city is the town where, frankly, probably 10 to 20,000 people come and shop during the summer, and with $90 million here, they still get zero. And I think it's because of the phase-out of some of the grandfather provisions. But if you could take a look at that, and I'm not sure about the job overburden issue in those small rural towns, because I think Senator Scoy and I both have an issue with the real small towns. Oftentimes, the major employer is located, you know, a mile or two right outside the community. They're not in the city limits, but, you know, they're right on the outskirts of town, and that's where the major ethanol plant is or the wood products plant is or the major jobs are, and we don't count them. I think under this we probably don't count them as jobs in that community. So if there was some way to draw, you know, where there's not an adjacent city, but there is some ancillary large employers right outside the city, if there was some way to draw them in, because I think, I mean, the overburden is there, whether the jobs are within the city limits or if they're a mile outside. If you could, I think, give some consideration to that. I think they're pretty small changes, but, you know, would have small amount of money probably even, but some pretty dramatic impacts in some small towns that I think make an argument they have, you know, they have overburden too, but it maybe doesn't quite show yet. But I really appreciate the effort that everybody's put into this.
Mr. Chairman, Peterson? Senator Bach, to answer those questions, the first point is for this formula here, we only look at jobs for city over 5,000. The reason that we don't, for below 5,000, you have that doubling of the small city aid. The reason for that is below 5,000, the actual jobs data becomes very hard to put at a city level.
Okay.
For those communities that you're talking about, the problem with those overburdens are a lot harder to gather with those smaller cities. It's the smallest city formula itself is not nearly as good as the large city formula, which is the one that gets the bulk of the attention. And so looking at those are things we have to look at, but it's very difficult to get measure that overburden on those smaller cities because the data is a lot harder to get, basically.
And I understand and I appreciate that, but it is, I think we all understand it's real.
Yeah, no, yeah.
And if we could spend some time, you guys have done a great job, if you could spend some time trying to skin that cat, I think that there's some small communities that would appreciate that.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bach, you know, well, we had the look at the Representative Marquardt small city fix that we worked on last year, and I took a look at that again this year as we were putting this together and kind of tried to figure out a way to work through the small city stuff. It got really expensive, and I think we had to have it about $14 million to hold all the small cities harmless. And so when I, in the end, we kind of went down to this highest population, and then we thought when we do the overall LGA formula redo with this work group in the next run, that we would be working on that. But I did take a look at it, and, you know, I think we're going to get there. I don't exactly know how we're going to do it this year, but let's take, as you said, let's take a look and try to see if we can pull some of that in from just outside, if we can do some of that stuff.
Mr. Jamboy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bach, we know that this solution is not perfect, and we know there are cities, some cities in the metropolitan area that we would like to do better for as well, including the city of Excelsior, which has a tremendous percentage of its area in tax exempt property, and they don't do well under this proposal either. But we think it is a very significant improvement over the current system, and we are all pledging to work together while we have some time, if we can buy some time with this system, with the proposal that we've got on the table today, we can work on some of those issues and try to wrestle them to the ground.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, the Senate made a good effort last year toward funding LGA. I hope that we're able to do it again. I know we don't have a lot of money. We'll see where we go. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate it if you'd lay the Senate file over for possible inclusion in the property tax article.
The chair lays over Senate file 32.
Mr. Chair, 34. Just a quick comment.
I'm sorry. Senator Senger.
Senator Scoy, thank you for all your work you've done on that, or this particular effort. But again, I would also encourage you to look at, let's take a kind of a little longer look, if we could, at the small cities. I look at my own list, and there's a lot of reasons to smile, but in some cases, the poorest of the poor, the kind of city that would take three council meetings to decide on a fire hydrant, are being zeroed out. And I think we have to maybe kind of look at that a little bit, hopefully.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Scoy.
Senator Senjum, everybody knows there's issues with regard to the small cities distribution. It's hard to get good data and to figure out what the needs are there and to assess them. You know, we did have a proposal last year that we, you know, was something to work on. We thought we'd continue to look at it. What happened when we started looking at the runs on that small city fix, that I don't know exactly if it came from the League of Minnesota Cities or where. I have always called it Representative Marquardt's proposal because he's the one that brought it forward. In order to hold cities, you know, most of them harmless, it got to be, you know, pretty expensive, and I didn't think that this was the year for that. So we just doubled what the small cities are getting on that one side bar and made that other small change. But thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. The chair lays Senate file 3234 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article, the omnibus tax bill. The next bill that on our agenda is Senate file 2082, Senator Wergen. Thank you. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here with Senate File 2082, but I want to take just 1 second before I start to reassure the committee of just a couple things. So I hope that the senators are hearing what I'm going to say, because it's very important. This bill, members, is absolutely not about annexation. I want to make that clear. It's not to do anything with annexation, and it's not introduced as a vehicle for annexation. I'm serving on the Municipal Boundary Adjustments Task Force, which is doing a great job of working with cities and townships on annexation issues, and my hope is that this year nothing gets touched with annexation unless it's gone through that committee. So that's not what this is about. Senate File 2082 came to my attention from the city of Big Lake because they share a special taxing district with the township of Big Lake. It's a significant portion of land, and it has a significant financial impact on the city and the township. However, what happens when there are levy limits, the income from that special taxing district all goes to the city, and then they send it out to the township. So if you do levy limits and there's any increases, all of it counts against the city, even though half of it only ends up with the city because of the agreement. So all this bill does, in a simple sentence, is says that special taxing districts, if there is a levy limit event, are exempt from levy limits. And I have with me the Chief Financial Officer from the City of Big Lake, Corey Boyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Boyer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. We approached Senator Wergen some time ago about this, and really the main issue that we deal with, as she mentioned, with these orderly annexation areas is we do, as the city receive the tax dollars and through our agreement with the township, we do share those dollars. A lot of times what happens in the case in Big Lake is that we have a lot of these orderly annexation areas are more of the high growth areas of the city, and so we have and generally, in this case, it happens to be a commercial industrial area. And so we see a lot of growth happening. And when that growth is outpacing growth in other areas of the city, if there are levy limits imposed on the city, it does impact us because we've got to share that higher tax burden with the township. And so, in effect, what happens with cities if there are strict levy limits is that we actually lose operating dollars because we're having to share a bigger chunk with the township.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Wergen and Mr. Boyer. You know, we haven't had levy limits for a while, and I appreciate your concern on this. And, you know, we'll consider this, but I think that if levy limits ever do come back, and I've never supported them, and I'm not considering them this year, but if they do, I would guess that we're going to re-look at the whole process that this is provision that Senator Wergen is bringing forward now, we would be addressing at that time because we understand that there is some concern among communities about that.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Wergen?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's all I have. We just wanted to call it to your attention. We're hoping that even though we know special levy limits are not being discussed right now, and Mr. Chair, I happen to, well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, whomever, yeah. I happen to agree with you. I think local governments need to be accountable for their own budgets. I think we've gotten in the predicament of talking about levy limits because in the cases of many local units of government, they blame the state for property tax increases in a lot of cases unjustly or beyond what actually is fact. And so it creates an atmosphere down here of if they're going to blame us, then let's control it. But I, like you, like to see local authority stay where it belongs. But we do want to make sure that if that discussion comes up or does become the case, that these special taxing districts are exempt because it has a profound impact on the levy limit for some of our cities, especially in the growth areas.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. Chair lays over Senate File 2082 for further consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you.
Senator Vanderveer, Senate File 1647 was a little oversight on my part. At the time we scheduled this, we didn't see that this provision is included in the tax bill that the Senate passed yesterday. There's one small little difference with regard to the area being, instead of 2 acres, it's 3 acres. But if my recollection is, you carried this as an amendment on the Senate floor last year, and this provision has already passed the Senate. So I apologize for not catching that, but I don't believe that we need to move this bill. Now, we have a lot of gentlemen here, and, you know, we can hear some testimony from them, but let's keep it quite short, because this has already passed the Senate this year.
Mr. Chair, then this will be real short, because we, our next bill, I think we've worked out.
Senator Vanderveer, I'm sorry. It's going to be on the floor today.
Yes.
I apologize.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. It has passed the House twice and the Senate once, so.
Sorry.
It has passed the House twice and the Senate once. So, but if there is a, well, we can't change what's in the omnibus now anyway, can we? To get the two to line up, the House and Senate version, if they didn't.
We're working off the House file.
With regard
Senator
to the 2 acres.
Senator Vanderveer, we're working off the House file, and we had the House file in committee yesterday, is what my what I was thinking about when we passed it. And it is going to the floor, and amendments can be offered.
Yes.
And amendments can be offered.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I know that the more you talk, the less chance you have of success, so I think we should, we're good, and we'll leave this where it is.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Vanderveer. Do the gentlemen, just a half a minute to who you are and what you represent since you traveled to the Capitol.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Weiss. I'm with the American Legion, representing 3rd District, Department of Minnesota. Real briefly, mine is a small post, very unique. We're dealing with over $60,000 worth of property taxes a year, and our commitments to the community and all our school and functions that we take care of are in excess of requirements of $150,000. So that pretty much tells the story. We're on the ropes and we need some help.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My name is Harry Sell. I'm past commander of VFW Post 4210 of Forest Lake. All I'd like to testify is that at this time, it's been a hardship for all clubs. And the reason it's a hardship is the economy, the recession, and the new smoking ban. All of this has been a result of a 20 to 30% decrease in our profits, which is hurting our club quite a bit. And it's all clubs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. And I remember Senator Vanderveer working on the floor last year, and we had discussions about it. He's
and Mr. Chair,
good idea, and we'll do what we
if
can.
If I could, I would thank you and Senator Bach, because you were instrumental in helping getting this in the
thank
bill.
You, Senator
so thank
Vanderveer.
You.
And should we move to Senate File 2410? Oh, Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, if I could, we just had a discussion with revenue. My constituent, who was also representing the Christmas Tree Growers Association, we just had a discussion with revenue, and I think we're in a position where we've resolved this particular problem, and we want to work on it, if we could, over the interim, and then if we need to come back, we will. Otherwise, we don't need to bother the committee with this today, if that's all right with you.
Oh, that sounds very good, Senator Vanderveer. We'll look forward to you introducing a bill next year then, and then we won't have testimony. Thank you, Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you.
Committee members, I have a bill on the bottom of the agenda. It now has the number 3501, And I'm going to talk briefly about this county aid program. It's written in the bill as a county that has an age-adjusted population greater than 5% that is receiving food stamps, but that is Beltrami County, for anybody questioning what the county is. And Beltrami County had an unusual situation of not having the ability to access the Title IV-E federal funds for their out-of-home placement costs this last year. It was a significant burden on the property taxpayers. It looks like it's going to be a significant burden on the property taxpayers because as they couldn't access those federal funds, it will fall on the property taxpayers, and this is an effort to afford that county some relief, and I would like to lay Senate File 3501 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Any more discussion? No more work for the committee. The committee is adjourned.
I'm impressed, yeah.